Okay. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court.
Good morning to everyone. Our third panel member, Judge Rovner, will be participating in the oral argument and the later deliberations of the court by telephone today. She is necessarily absent, so she will hear the arguments and be able to ask questions and as if she were here. Our first case of the morning is number 051417. Linda J. Parker against Joanne B. Barnett, the Commissioner of Social Security. Mr. Rowe.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your
Honors. Good morning.
This appeal, Your Honor, deals with a denial of an individual's application for Social Security disability benefits. The claimed basis of disability in this particular case is a particular disease called interstitial cystitis, a little-known and very difficult to diagnose and treat disease. Its primary symptoms, which amount to conceitedly non-exertional limitations, are frequency and urgency of urination, sometimes leading to the need to urinate as many as 50 or 70 times a day. In preparation for the petitioner's case, she had asked her treating physicians to prepare and submit to the administrative law judge and to the Social Security Administration a document called a residual functional capacity evaluation, in which are set forth the limitations that the treating physicians felt that she had.
This is Judge Rosner. Good morning.
Good morning.
Before you go further into the third, I would like to ask you some questions regarding Rule 4. It appears to me that even if the treating of the date couldn't label the excusable neglect or good cause, that there may still be a problem. Even if we thought that the date shift said December 16th, December 15th, 50 days after December 16th is February 13th, which was a Sunday. So, Ms. Parker was required to file on that date, February 14th, but nothing was filed
until February 15th. What would be the good cause for filing on February 15th rather than February 14th? The only good cause that I have, Judge, and I believe that there's case law that sustains this, is that since I don't practice in the area of the district court, I had to send it by mail, and I believe the indication would be I sent it by overnight mail, but even then it was too late. I would go further, Your Honor, and indicate I'm not sure that issue is properly before this court.
Our jurisdiction is always proper.
Well, but I think that the jurisdiction is apparent. I believe that the government's obligation, in light of the fact that it felt that the district court's order was issued for invalid purposes or for not sufficient purposes, was to appeal that order rather than trying to raise it as an issue in this case. I think that the fact that the court granted the order extending the time for appeal gives this court jurisdiction absent some sort of an appeal of the district court's, the validity of the district court's order, and that was not done in this case.
Well, of course, the district court judge didn't discuss even if that had been done, the confusion over hard to resist. I really hope to get to that one every day. Not the two. It's just
as I say, the extra day was as a result of mailing time from where I practice law as opposed to where the district court is. I will confess to you that the issuance of the district court order in a fashion it did surprised even me. I was prepared and had researched the issue to brief the entire issue of the untimeliness of the appeal. And in my motion to the district court had asked for a briefing schedule, an opportunity to be heard on that. The order was issued almost immediately, which left me as the petitioner in the awkward position of either going back to the district court and saying, no, don't issue your order so quickly. Let's have an opportunity for the parties to brief it, or accepting the order and pursuing the appeal in this court. But I will confess that I was surprised by the quickness with which the district court issued the order. I'm sorry? Okay. In any event, setting that issue aside, I would submit to the court that the central issue on appeal in this case is the disregard of the functional capacity evaluation by the administrative law judge. His basis for doing so, apparently, is the fact that the evaluation is obviously prepared by a physician's assistant with whom the treating physician worked and signed originally by the physician's assistant. The treating physician, however, then reviewed the document and wrote in his own hand at the bottom of the document, I agree with the above and have discussed it with Mr. Ingram, who's the physician's assistant.
I wonder if you could help me with one other question that is on my mind. And that's this. Did Ms. Parker need 20 to 25 bathroom breaks per work day or 20 to 25 bathroom breaks per 24 hour day?
Ms. Parker was subject to a need to urinate on an average of 2 to 5 times an hour. During an 8-hour workday, that would be anywhere from 16 to 40 times an hour.
So we're talking about work. Because, you know, I'm not sure that everyone was so careful about the term day.
Well, didn't she admit that that was a bit of an exaggeration during the hearing and was probably 20 times during the whole 24-hour day?
I think that she misunderstood the question. I think that when she testified to about 70 times a day, she admitted that that might be an exaggeration. I don't think that it was an exaggeration.
Well, be it 70 or be it 20, that's still a lot of bathroom breaks, I guess. Huh?
But that's the point, Your Honor, is that that's the primary characteristic of the disease. To fail to accept her credibility on that issue is also to attack the basis upon which the treating physician made the diagnosis. Because, as you well know, the disease is so difficult to diagnose. It's often the last chance diagnosis. It's the one that's made after everything else is ruled out, and it's done primarily on the basis of the patient's own description of the symptoms. And as you know from the record, Ms. Parker was asked by the treating physicians to keep a log of her daily urination, which she did. That log was the basis upon which the physician indicated the number of times that he felt she would need to urinate during a day on the residual functional capacity evaluation.
Now, she needed to use the bathroom the second that she felt the urge to urinate. Is that correct?
Are you meaning always, Your Honor? Part of the problem is the urgency of urination as well. So certainly, as the record reflects, the number of times she left the room during the hearing would be a response to the urgency to urinate.
In other words, this is not an individual who could wait for regular
That is correct.
In other words, so if the moment she feels the urge to do it, she has to get to a bath. Is that correct?
Yes. That's characteristic of the disease. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time, judges. Thank you. Unless there are any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. We'll hear now from Ms. Kim.
Good morning, Your Honor. Grace Kim for the Commissioner of Social Security. It's the Commissioner's position that this court does not have appellate jurisdiction over this matter because counsel for Ms. Parker did file her notice of appeal one day late in violation and has failed to show excusable neglect in providing reasons for that one-day delay. We also submit that the district court, in granting Ms. Parker's extension of time to file the notice of appeal, was an abuse of discretion, since the district court made no finding whatsoever with respect to whether the reason for the delay was a result of excusable neglect or good cause. As Judge Rovner pointed out, regardless of how you review the district court judgment, whether it was entered on the 14th or the 15th or even the 16th, the deadline for filing the notice of appeal was February 14th, 2005.
Well, is the better remedy then to send it back to the district court to make a finding of excusable neglect?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. We submit that this court can make that determination on its own, as it has done in other cases, because the reasons that Ms. Parker provided to the district court are no different than the reasons that...
Well, but what if they have other reasons? You know, you got to look at their point. They file a request for additional time, and it's granted. So what are they supposed to do? We'll go back in and give you more reasons why you should grant it?
Well, Your Honor, Ms. Parker's counsel has been given ample opportunity to provide those reasons to this court. This court ordered Ms. Parker's counsel to brief the issue of jurisdiction. Mr. Rowe did do that, and basically his reasons amount to simple miscalculation. The cases cited in the commissioner's brief, the cases cited in Mr. Rowe's jurisdictional memo, and the arguments that he's making today do not support a finding of excusable neglect where the attorney simply miscalculates the deadline. And now Mr. Rowe contends that because he is unfamiliar with federal practice, that somehow constitutes excusable neglect or good cause on his part. However, he knew to count 60 days from the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure. He knew that he had 60 days to file his notice of appeal. His error, however,
was... The problem is that a lot of lawyers, when they're told 60 days and it's February 15th, they think 60 days is, April 15th, but I guess maybe they shouldn't wait until the last minute.
Well, I think the rules are pretty clear, Your Honor, that 60 days runs from the entry of judgment.
I understand.
And if Mr. Rowe was confused or uncertain about what the date stamp said on the entry of judgment, he should have consulted with the docket. He has attached a copy of the district court docket to his brief, and that docket clearly states that judgment was entered on December 15th. There's simply no excuse why Mr. Rowe filed his notice of appeal one day late in this case. And for that reason, we submit that this court does not have appellate jurisdiction in this matter and should dismiss this appeal for that reason. In the alternative, should this court find that it does have appellate jurisdiction, we ask that this court affirm the commissioner's decision on the merits. Ms. Parker challenges the ALJ's decision only with respect to the ALJ's findings regarding her urinary problems, which have been diagnosed as interstitial cystitis.
Before we move on from the jurisdictional issue, did the district court act in time? Was the district court's order timely?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court issued its order, I believe, on March 15th, 4 days after Mr. Rowe filed his motion for extension of time.
Okay, go on.
This case involves an individual who has had long-standing problems with urination frequency, urgency, and pain. And these are symptoms that Ms. Parker has worked with for many, many years. After she and her husband moved to northern Wisconsin in 1999, it was at that point that she was first diagnosed with interstitial cystitis. The ALJ in this case fully considered Ms. Parker's complaints regarding her urinary frequency and urgency and pain in light of the record before him, which included state agency opinions, medical expert testimony at the hearing, voluminous treatment records, and the statements by Ms. Parker and her husband. The ALJ found that Ms. Parker's interstitial cystitis was severe and accordingly limited her to work that accounted for two unanticipated bathroom breaks in addition to the normal breaks one would get, two breaks and a lunch break that a person would normally get during a normal work day. In essence, the ALJ basically found that Ms. Parker could perform work that allowed her to basically use the bathroom 7 to 8 hours within an 8-hour workday. Now, Ms. Parker contends that the ALJ erred because he did not adopt the opinion of a physician assistant, Mr. Ingram. It's the agency's position, however, that the ALJ reasonably rejected that opinion because it was an opinion by a physician assistant who is not a medically acceptable source. The ALJ's attribution of that report to Mr. Ingram was reasonable because that report or that opinion was clearly based on his relationship with Ms. Parker, which pretty much amounted to her coming into the office, telling him what her subjective complaints were, and then he would monitor the progress of her condition.
Did the physician's assistant provide any treatment?
He was overseeing her medications and following up with her treatment.
And following up with her treatment. Are you, from the tone of your brief, I had the sense you were urging a categorical rule in this case, as opposed to a rule limited to the facts of this case. Did I read your brief correctly?
A categorical rule meaning that no physician's opinion or physician's assistant's opinion could be considered?
No, a physician assistant's opinion when ratified by responsible physician.
It's our position that this case is different from the case cited by Ms. Parker in her brief, the Gomez case, where there was evidence that the nurse practitioner in that case was working very closely with the attending physician in rendering treatment for Ms. Gomez. In this case, we don't have that evidence that there was constant interaction between Dr. Bailey and Mr. Ingram. Furthermore, Ms. Parker testified at the hearing that she always saw Mr. Ingram. She only saw Dr. Bailey for her initial visit and then for these certain procedures, like when she underwent cystoscopy and she had these instillation treatments.
So for any significant testing, she saw the physician?
That's correct.
Or for any significant treatment intervention, she saw the physician?
That's correct. And we believe that this report really was the product of a relationship with Mr. Ingram because the report itself contains what we believe are her subjective complaints. The amount of time she's saying, the amount and number of times she needed to use the bathroom per day. But as Ms. Parker admitted at the hearing, she exaggerated that number. And the number was 50, not 70, as counsel has said.
The reason I stop you on this point is, and my concern is, that if your administration is pressing for a categorical rule here, it's going to trench very hard, in a very, very hard way, on a lot of people who, frankly, depend on walk-in clinics for their medical care in this country. and see physician's assistants or nurse practitioners as a matter of course. I mean, they don't get to see an MD very often. They don't have the money to. Wouldn't it be contrary to the statute you administered if we had a categorical rule?
Actually, Your Honor, the statute and the regulations require that the opinion be completed by a medically acceptable source. In this particular case,
I understand that.
I'm sorry.
I understand that, but do they require, as presently written, do they exclude the possibility of ratification by the doctor?
I don't believe so if the doctor is involved in the treatment. In this case, Dr. Bailey endorsed Mr. Ingram's opinion over a month later. And
involvement.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Surely
He was, Your Honor, but the RFC opinion was not the product of an examination by the doctor. Now, Mr. Ingram does mention the cystoscopy procedure that Dr. Bailey performed, but the RFC opinion really contains subjective complaints of Ms. Parker's.
Unless you had someone, attention to you in the bathroom every time you went, won't it always be somewhat subjective? You'd have to have a monitor with you to make it objective. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. And the ALJ did consider Ms. Parker's contention that she used the bathroom anywhere from 20 to 50 times a day. However, at the hearing, the ALJ considered her complaints but then weighed them against the other evidence. She testified at the hearing that she had exaggerated her testimony that she had used the bathroom 50 times a day. She was referring to these logs that she kept, which counsel has not admitted into the records. There's no way that we know. There's no indication that those logs represent her need to use the bathroom for years on end. It could be during a period when she had an exacerbation, for example. And there's supporting medical evidence in the record to suggest that there were periods when she did not have the type of frequency and symptoms that she's alleging in her claim before this court. And I can see that my time is up. So,
unless there are any other questions from the panel, thank you, Ms. Kim.
Thank you.
How much time? Mr. Rowe, you have a minute, but since we ran a bit over with counsel for the government, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you. I'd like to follow up on the questions posed by the court to Ms. Kim. I really believe that the Social Security Administration is urging a viewpoint on you that represents an archaic understanding of the way the medicine is practiced. When a person like Ms. Parker goes to a big regional clinic like Marshfield Clinic, perhaps the original diagnostic testing and evaluation is done by a physician, in this case a board-certified urologist or several of them. But after that, once the diagnosis is made, the interim treatment is done by a physician's assistant. And I think it wasn't at Ms. Parker's request. She didn't even know that Mr. Ingram was a physician's assistant. But when she went in, she was seeing a physician's assistant. But if you look at the records, the medical records, and I understand they're voluminous, you will see that every time that Ms. Parker met with the physician's assistant, that note is countersigned by one of the physicians, not always Dr. Bailey, but sometimes Dr. Roach, the other treating urologist in this case. That's the way that medicine is practiced, even in northern Wisconsin, in places like the Marshfield Clinic. And
well,
for the
Marshfield Clinic is the crown jewel of northern Wisconsin.
So it would tell us. I agree with that. The other point I wanted to make is this. The record in this case, and the decision of the administrative law judge, is replete with inferences that he's not accepting. the way that that kind of medicine is treated, and he's not accepting the way in which the doctors and the physician's assistant assisted in this diagnosis. And he has questions about perhaps the whole nature of the disease and the characteristics of the disease. I'm not sure how, having rejected all of that, he could come up with a finding that Ms. Parker suffers from severe cystitis. I'm not sure where he's getting that from, if not from the records generated by her treating physicians. But in any event, that's the reason why, in my brief and in my request to the court, I mentioned the possibility of remand, because, as you know, the Social Security Administration has now issued, since the date of the hearing before the administrative law judge, a ruling that deals entirely with interstitial cystitis and is supposed to assist the ALJ in questions of determining the nature of the disease, the characteristics, the symptoms, and the diagnosis. And so, if for any reason you don't feel comfortable in reversing the ALJ's decision, I would suggest strongly that you consider this case for a remand. I ask you to look carefully at the ALJ's decision and see whether or not it in any way complies with the Social Security ruling that requires him to explain why he didn't give the weight to the treating physician's opinions, and whether he did that in a way that allows a subsequent reviewer of the issue to understand what he was doing. I submit to you, you can't understand why the ALJ rejected. Thank you.
I have the point. Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Our thanks indeed to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.